Hey everyone, you're listening to On Their Behalf, formerly known as DNA, a True Crime Podcast. Please enjoy.
Hey, and welcome back to DNA, a True Crime Podcast. I'm Devin, the D.
And I'm Asia, the A.
And we talk about true crime. So, how are you doing?
How are you? I've only seen you through a screen
for
the past 2 weeks.
Because we're being responsible.
Yeah. It's sad, though, because I'm not normally a hugger, but when I do go outside, I have this really weird urge to hug people, but it's because I'm, like, now being told I can't.
Yes.
Even though that's not, like, my thing. I'm not very a touchy-feely person, mm-hmm. so, but now, like, I feel like I haven't had, like, human contact in so long that, like, even random people I kind of want to just, like, can I just squeeze somebody for a second,
Yeah. Well, no, you can't.
No.
But I understand the feeling. I also started like self-quarantining or like self-isolating, whatever, March 8th, which is like 2 weeks before everybody else started, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just because, like, that's how my life has been. I don't have a job right now, and like there wasn't really a lot of
nobody
stuff
does
going on. Yeah, well, now nobody does.
What are you doing? Like, what? See, what I'm doing, obviously, I think I've FaceTimed people and friends and family more than I have ever FaceTimed.
I have
people.
Never been so social, and I can't, because I also can't get out of plans now. So it's like I want to do things, but it's like
everybody knows you're
like,
home,
oh,
so
I'm
they're
busy
like
to do this stuff. The other thing is like I'm being social with people that like I love, so it doesn't feel like a lot. Like I'm very much an introvert, and I need, like, I like socializing, but I need that alone time. And my friend Erica calls it not people. So you know how you're like, I don't really like people, but then there's certain friends and loved ones that are not people, and I feel like I've been like hanging out with my not people friends a lot.
Sometimes if I've had a really busy day and I'm like running around or I'm working or whatever the case is, I always feel like I just need to shut off the world.
Yeah.
And do something that doesn't require my brain to do anything other than just like sit.
Right.
And, you know, like I need that time to, you know, separate myself from the world, but I've been forced to do that for now going on 3 weeks. So
that now I need the stimulation.
Now I need the stimulation of things that I actually used to put to the side. And like, another thing that's like really, I mean, my mom, she doesn't listen to the podcast because she doesn't like, these stories are too much for her.
That's fair.
She, like, a couple times I've like FaceTimed her and she didn't answer. And I'm like really hurt. Like, I'm like, are you serious?
She loves you.
Mom, why aren't you answering me? And she was like, I was in the shower.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you can't. You can't do that to me.
But that's the other thing is that, like, I've been reading a lot of articles. I've been staying engaged until I'm not. Mm. And then I will, like, have my phone in the other room. I will not be looking at a screen. You know, I'll be coloring or doing something, you know.
Yeah.
But I won't look at my phone for a full day, which has never happened before.
I'm staying off of social media as much as I can because you can't go anywhere on social media without seeing at least, you know, 5 or 6 million posts about it. And it just creates
five or
more
six
anxiety for me.
Million.
Yeah.
I was like, only five or six? Oh, million.
Got it. Okay. Like million. No, for sure. Like every post you see.
I'm trying
and
to like,
it just creates more anxiety for me. And
I'm trying to find a balance of like paying attention and not going crazy, which that's a hard balance to strike. I've been making a lot of lists because I'm a Virgo and I feel in control when I have a list. Like, today I made a list of like, what would I need to do to join the FBI?
Really?
Yeah, because why not? Turns out you have to be under 36, so I'm fine. But there's like a very rigorous interview process. But I made a list of a list I was looking at online. So and that's where I'm at.
Okay. All right. Coloring books, puzzles. I've done 2 puzzles already.
Nice.
Nothing too crazy, you know, 500 pieces.
All right.
So, you know, I'm not going too far. My sister does like 1,000 pieces.
Oh,
and
my
I'm like,
gosh.
Yeah, okay, no.
So much. I've been watching RuPaul's Drag Race, which is just a delight. And I know I'm late to the game on this, but I'm starting from season one. It's really fun. Yeah. And what I really love about it is that it's like, it's such a joyful profession. And like, they get into like the challenges that these people have faced. And, you know, you're a drag queen. You're not in the normal, like, you know, people are not going to like you and people are not going to accept your life, but they choose joy and comedy and fun and glamour despite all that, and they celebrate it. And I think it's such like a positive message, and I really it. Yeah. I love it.
It's definitely a relief from what's going on, for sure.
For sure. Yeah. So should we let's get back to the
let's get into
let's do our job. This week we got a few new reviews on iTunes, so we want to say thank you and shout out. And we got some shout outs on Instagram, so you should follow us at @DNA_podcast.
Yep.
Shout us out. Let us know what you're listening to. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, all the stuff. We want to hear from you. And for our iTunes reviews, we want to shout out and thank Miguel Manos Frios for your 5-star review on Sunday. So kind. My wonderful friend Colleen for your 5-star review. She's been texting me and saying she works in the healthcare industry in Washington, and she's been saying it's been such a nice escape for her to listen to this, which I really appreciate. And I love you. And I miss you, Colleen. And then we want to thank Garland Lafayette for our first 1-star review.
Yeah, 1 out of 30.
1 star. Yeah, 1 out of 30. Yeah. 1 star for obscene language. Mm-hmm. Not a fan of the obscene language. But which thank is you okay. for rating. Yeah. That's okay.
Thanks for taking the time out to let us know that you don't like that we curse. However, I think the thing that I had a problem with that first was like, oh my God, Devin, we have a 1-star review. And her response, what did you say to me? I think you said,
I was like, well, that's so exciting.
That's so exciting. And then you were like, well, I guess you're nobody until somebody hates you. And I was like, I guess you're right. I mean, we want to address it. Obviously, it's, you know, reviews in general are what they are. And
everyone's entitled to their own opinion. That's fine.
Exactly. But I'd like to say, you know, these aren't stories. And if, you know, these are real people's lives, and the reason we express ourselves sometimes in a not so great way is because we are infuriated by these stories, or these true stories. Right. And honestly,
I think that's the key, is that like, that review said that like, that review said specifically that we ruin the story with our obscene language. And to us, this is not us talking. It's not gossip. It's not something like that. It's not like...
And we're not fabricating these stories in any way. Right. These are real people's lives.
These are stories.
Tragic things that have happened to people. And, you know, we express ourselves in that way because we are infuriated. And... honestly, if the thing that makes you mad about our podcast is our cursing and not the terrible, horrible things that are happening to these people, then maybe true crime isn't your thing. But either way, thank you guys so much for reviewing us. And
if you listening want to shout out, go leave us a review.
Yeah.
And then tag us on Instagram to say that it's you that left the review.
And we
so that we know, because sometimes the names are different. We don't know who you are.
Yeah. Actually, wasn't there one review that we were like, oh my gosh, we had no idea that that was somebody that we knew?
Yeah, that was my friend Colleen.
Oh, was it Colleen?
Yeah, that's what I was telling you about. Because her name is Coco Citrus. I don't know who it is.
Yeah.
It's Colleen.
Just a little disclaimer here. We discuss true crime, real life things that happen to people, and sometimes what we talk about isn't suitable for everybody. So please don't listen to this around your children, or just use discretion. Also,
we also have sailor mouths.
We do. Sometimes we get angry and we curse a little bit. And just so you know, obscene language will be said throughout this entire podcast. And this week we are going to be telling the story together. It is also a very, very, very big case. So we will be splitting this episode into two parts.
And our first two-parter.
Yeah, it's our first two-parter. And we did not realize how insane it was going to be to split this up. And there was no way we were going to be able to one of us tell this story solo. So we decided to do it together. And then after trying to tackle a way to split it, it was like, we can't. We have to do this in two parts. So we will be telling you guys the case of the Toronto serial killer.
So have you ever been to Toronto?
No, I have not.
I have. I went once when I was 19. It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And the locals actually say Toronto.
Oh.
So okay. I'm going to probably say it like that because I, you know, like to do accents.
Yeah. And just so you know, Devin just flipped her hair as she said that. I am not a accent person, so I'll probably just say Toronto.
That's fine. But this case actually takes place in the heart of Toronto, in the Church Wellesley Village, which is like, you know, the Castro in San Francisco or West Hollywood in LA. It's just like the hub of all the LGBTQ lifestyle businesses and everything. It's very, like, it's a great location in Toronto. It's, like, a few blocks northeast from the Eaton Center, which is, like, the big shopping center. A few blocks east of Queen's Park and the Royal Ontario Museum. So it's in a really nice area, nice neighborhood. It's a very historic neighborhood with, like, beautiful old Victorian houses. And for the month of June, they host every single pride event that you can imagine.
Oh, cool.
So they have the big pride parade, they have smaller parades, they have all these events. A lot of the, you know, LGBTQ businesses are based there, and a lot of the surrounding neighborhoods are populated with LGBTQ families. So it's just like, it's actually one of Toronto's biggest attractions. And when I was there, it was like a reggae fest. And
oh, cool. Like,
parade went through it, everything. It was really cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's just absolutely beautiful. And it was a really important place, you know, for decades, because it became like a safe haven for LGBTQ people that weren't necessarily accepted to come and have a community. And now that, you know, there's things are more progressive, laws are changing, people are being more open, there's been a little bit of a debate about how important it is to, like, save the Church Wellesley Village. But I think people just totally understand that it's, like, it's so important to, even though, like, being gay, being lesbian, being trans is moving forward and becoming more accepted, there's still a lot of backlash, there's still a lot of negativity surrounding it. Or not directed towards it, not surrounding it, excuse me. And it's so important for people to have a safe community away from, like, the quote-unquote straight white world. So even if, like, you know, everything is very accepting in your life, it's, like, it's still not the same if you're the only, like, gay person in a room of straight people. You know, it's been very important and been a very safe community where the people looked out for each other.
They
knew everybody. Everybody had each other's backs for decades. And it has been sort of at the forefront of the LGBTQ rights movement in Canada. And Canada is actually considered the most gay-friendly country in the whole world.
Really?
Which I thought was really cool. Yeah. Just a couple of stats about that. Same-sex acts were deemed lawful in Canada in 1969. And now, comparatively, some parts of the U.S. made them legal in 1962, but it wasn't legal nationwide in the U.S. until 2003.
Wow.
So you couldn't, like, hook up with your boyfriend if you were a man in certain parts of the U.S. and not be breaking the law until 2003. So,
wow.
Just in Canada, gay marriage was legalized in 2005, which is 10 years before it was legalized in the U.S. Yeah. And in 2019, Justin Trudeau announced his intention to ban conversion therapy. There's been a ton of debate about where, you know, the government in Canada, anyway, the government can, like, infringe upon and restrict conversion therapy because a lot of times it's presented as a religious thing.
Yeah.
And there's been big debates over it. And it hasn't totally moved forward or voted into law yet, but I don't know if I've ever heard a president in the U.S. mention conversion therapy at all.
No.
So already, like,
yeah,
way
leaps and bounds way, for sure.
Leaps and bounds, yeah. So all that being said, there's still like not there. There's still a lot of very rural places in Canada with very strong religious ties. Very, you know, same as here. You know, a little bit less worldview, maybe a little bit more conservative. So it's not like everybody is just like totally gung-ho for LGBTQ, which is why places like Church Wellesley have become so important and are still so iconic.
Yeah, and should be protected because, you know, everybody, I feel like you have the right to feel safe in your community.
Exactly.
And even if it's a community that you've built in, you know, even though it was like not like accepted by everybody, like even though you've built this community, you deserve to be protected and feel safe.
Yeah. So everybody deserves that. And this case totally, totally abuses that and takes advantage of members of this beautiful, supportive community in a really horrifying way. Just another little disclaimer. some of the names in this case are trickier, and you know, we don't have the language to back up our pronunciation, so begging forgiveness.
Yes, forgive us, please.
Yes. So the first person I want to talk to you about was Skandaraj Navaratnam.
Okay.
He went by Skanda. I hope I'm saying that right. Skanda was a Sri Lankan Tamil refugee. So what that means is that in Sri Lanka, there's a community of people called the Tamil people that were ethnically from India, but had settled in Sri Lanka. And in the 1940s, a law was passed that basically like discriminated everything against the Tamil people. And so for decades, the government actively deported and discriminated against these people. And so many fled the country in hopes of a better life. And Skanda was one of those people. He went from being in a really volatile situation in Sri Lanka. He was forced to hide the fact that he was gay until he came to Canada. The primary religions of the Tamil people are Hindu, Catholic, and Protestant. So being gay was not like a very welcome thing. Skanda had no family in Canada, so he was alone, but he made a name for himself in the community at Church Wellesley Village. He found a job working for a local landscaping business. He was charming, charismatic, friendly. His brother Navasilan Navaratnam said that Skanda was, quote, the live wire in our family and a jovial character since childhood. And while he was working and living in Canada, he was also financially supporting his family back home. So,
okay, so he was sending money
just,
home?
Like, he was sending money home. And, like, the description that his brother gave, like, the live wire in our family and a jovial character since childhood, I can just, like, immediately know who this guy is. Like, he just, the life of the party, a joy. Everybody liked him. Like, no wonder he made so many friends.
Yeah.
And, like, had such a big impact in this community. His longtime friend Kevin Nash said, if you knew Skanda, you would love him. He was very attractive, handsome young man with a charismatic attitude who loved to laugh. Skanda had a few romantic relationships while living in Canada, one with Nash's friends and another with Skanda's boss at the landscaping company named Bruce MacArthur. Now, Skanda was last seen over Labor Day weekend in 2010. He was last seen at a nightclub called Zippers leaving with an unknown man. Scanda used to text his best friend Jean-Guy Cloutier. Jean-Guy Cloutier, if you're French. So he would text him every morning, and when Jean-Guy didn't hear from him for a few days, he reported him missing. Jean-Guy called his friend the most outgoing person with a personality to go with it, who was always there to help out his friends. Skanda was an animal lover and an environmentalist who worked to protect the forest and jungles in his native Sri Lanka. And maybe most importantly, apparently he was unbeatable at Scrabble.
What?
Which I was like, dang, like, I can't, I only speak English and I'm terrible at Scrabble.
Me too. Oh, like, my God, it's so bad.
That is.
And I'm always like, when I play like Words for Friends online, oh my God, I'm always like, I'm cheating all the time.
I don't
because
even
I have
play
no
it.
Idea.
So this guy is like charming, smart, life of the party, like just literally probably goals in every way. Like,
yeah,
I quoted like four friends that he had.
Saying that.
So Skanda was 40 years old when he went missing on September 6, 2010.
Okay.
Switching gears a little bit. Abdu Basir Faizi disappeared December 29th, 2010, right after Christmas. Mm-hmm. Basir was living a double life. He was married to a woman. They had two kids together. He was a fixture at the Church Wellesley scene, where he was finally able to express his true sexuality. So he had two total different lives going on. He had one where he was the family man, you know, religious, loving husband, loved his kids so much, and the other where he was an openly gay man. And that pressure of, like, you know, having all these secrets, really, I can't imagine having to go through that. That feels so difficult.
Yeah, and, like, having that, like, added pressure of either side finding out about the other. You know, it's like, you know, you have, you know, a community of friends who know the true you, and for them to find out that you're hiding this entire other part of your life and the other way around is, like,
I do imagine that in the gay community there, everyone has had maybe similar
experiences,
especially in that generation where you do have to hide a part of yourself. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they probably were supportive and understanding, but also encouraging him to live his true life, which is terrifying. If you're going to give up, you know, you might never see your kids again. You don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. So I totally understand being stuck. Mm. But Basir was funny, smart, and he loved his kids. And his wife and daughters had no idea that he was gay until he disappeared. On December 29th, Basir called his wife to tell her that he was working late, and that was the last time that she spoke to him. His cousin reported him missing when he didn't come home the next day, and a week later, the police discovered his abandoned car in the wealthy neighborhood on Mallory Crescent. Later, what happened was that his wife actually wound up filing divorce papers, citing that Basir abandoned his family and didn't want to be found.
How long?
Which...
How long after that?
I don't know exactly when she filed, but he was missing for years.
Oh, my God.
Before people started to think that something was going on.
Yeah, well, I understand
But
that,
his
though.
Friends...
A little bit, yeah, because...
Well, yeah, especially if you don't... If he's just missing, you don't know he has a secret life and he just
did
goes
she know,
off somewhere. And then you're like, I have
did
to
Did she know
something.
That he was gay at that point? So...
The time of filing... For the divorce, yes, but which is also why she was like, oh, well, he was gay. He must not want to be with me. So she thought he just vanished, like he just ran off. But his friends in the Church Wellesley village knew otherwise because he had just spent his entire December working overtime to make sure that his kids got all the Christmas gifts they wanted. So they knew that he would just not leave. Right. So even though, you know, he was leading a double life, they knew that how much his family meant to him.
Isn't that so crazy that I'm sorry. Like his friends in the gay community knew him better than his wife, because his wife, after a couple of years, was like, "Oh, he just abandoned me.
He but didn't." But that's want not me. Her fault.
No, she it's not. No, no, no.
Kept things
from exactly. Her. But it's just so fascinating that, you know,
well, that's the what people, happens when you're honest.
Yeah, you like know? Those people were like, "No, no, no. He would never do something like that." And I'm sure she knew he was working overtime. All you know, he would tell her.
Yeah,
but like that thought. Well, never
he
crossed
was working
her mind.
Overtime, but then he was also hanging out in Church Wellesley. So
yeah,
it's that thing of like, you know, obviously he didn't do anything to deserve
no
what
no.
happened, but it shows how important being honest and being truthful with yourself is, even though you risk everything. It's just like, I've never had to go through that, so I can't really like speak to what that experience is at all. And I don't blame him for not like,
I don't blame him for not being truthful either, because the amount of, you know, judgment that would come from being truthful outweighs the pain you have to go through keeping it a secret.
And Basir was an immigrant from Afghanistan. His family was from Afghanistan. So it was also that added pressure of culturally something that was totally not accepted. So Basir said ultimately in her statement on her witness impact statement upon sentencing, which is coming later. She said that despite the double life and his sexuality, there still was a lot of love there and a lot of a good bond, and that his daughters are suffering terribly without him, and they always carry a picture of him so they don't forget him. I know. Basir was 44 when he went missing on December 29th, 2010. If that wasn't enough, there's another.
It doesn't.
There's a lot more.
It doesn't end, actually.
No, it really doesn't end. So this is that was the end of 2010.
Okay.
So two immigrants from the Church Wellesley community that people knew went missing very close to each other, within 4 months of each other, in the Church Wellesley community. That community, being LGBTQ, knowing historically that they're targeted for hate crimes, for terrible things, are starting to get a feeling that something's going on.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until Majid, who goes by Hamid Kayan, disappeared on October 18th, 2012, that people took action. So Hamid was an Afghan immigrant also living a double life, so a very similar situation to Basir. He actually lived on Church Street. So Church Wellesley is like the intersection where this is, the village is. He actually lived on Church Street and frequented the bars. Everybody knew him. He was also leading a W life. He was a refugee from Afghanistan and with a wife and a family. And his adult son reported him missing a week after the disappearance. Jaleel Kayhan, Hamid's brother, said that he was the youngest of a lot of siblings, and along with many older siblings, he leaves behind nieces and nephews, two children, and three grandchildren.
Oh, no.
So that is a serious family, a very serious double life. And to live on the street, like, he was in it.
Yeah.
So Hamid was 58 when he disappeared October 18th, 2012.
Wow.
Nearly 2 years after Basir disappeared.
Okay.
So in November 2012, the community outrage and the fact that three brown-skinned immigrant gay men went missing from what is supposed to be a very safe neighborhood, very safe, protected space, finally, the community got what they needed from Toronto Police Services, also known as TPS. And TPS created a task force called Project Houston. They took the community's concern about these three men disappearing very seriously, especially because not only, you know, are they kind of targeted because they have secrets, or in Skanda's case, he was alone. He didn't have family. Mm-hmm. He wasn't alone because he had a ton of friends, but
yeah.
It seemed like they all had similarities. So the community was like, we have a serial killer on our hands. And mm-hmm. TPS was like, let's not get out of hand here. Let's look into this. We don't know if they're dead. There's no bodies being found. They're just gone. So TPS starts this task force mm-hmm. And start looking into what happened for him. I mean, to all three of them. So they start by searching for Skanda specifically, and they start by searching Riverdale Park, which is a nearby park that was like a popular cruising spot, and they search with cadaver dogs and mounted patrols because Canada. Hmm. But nothing is turned up, and that they really thought was going to be like a hit because like it's the nearest park, closest to where everybody disappeared. Like, literally, it's like a 3-block like point where these people disappeared.
Yeah.
So they were really disappointed where they didn't find anything. Later on, they got a tip that a man was posting on a cannibal website that he had killed and eaten a man in Toronto, which, oh, just
what?
The fact that there is a cannibal website. Oh, I'm not going to say what it's called here because I don't want like people to look it up, but yeah. Like, gross. Oh, just so gross.
What year
so,
was this again?
That was in 2012.
What?
I know.
Okay.
So, all right. So they find that guy and they start following him. He was a guy named James Alex Brunton, who was 69 years old. And they eating
people apparently.
And he was a retired hospital technician, so like probably had access to the morgue. Just so disgusting. And the police surveilled him in person, so they had people following him. They had people tracking his online movements. They followed him for months. Mm-hmm. But in 2013, he was cleared as a murder suspect. I don't know exact. I think they just couldn't pin anything on him, couldn't connect him to the guys. There was mm-hmm. nothing that was like murder, so it wasn't yeah. tight enough.
Yeah.
But he did plead guilty to possessing, making, and distributing child pornography.
Ugh.
And entering into a cannibalistic sexual contract with a teenager from Colorado. I don't know what the fuck that means.
Yeah, what is that?
Don't know. I don't know who's eating who or what. I
oh my god, I don't know who's eating who. Wow.
That is getting into some really dark stuff that I don't know if I can handle.
Yeah. Oh god.
So that seems like a whole nother episode that I honestly don't know if I can do.
Yeah. Good. Thanks.
So basically, like, while they're finding interesting things out, TPS is, like, yeah. not getting anything during Project Houston. So they're finally, like, they're at the same time looking at the men's phones, the contacts, who they know. And it's, like, a very small community, so there's a lot of overlap with the people they know. There's dating apps and everything. So they look through everybody's contacts on dating apps and everything. They're interviewing friends, family, community members, including Kevin Nash, who is Skanda's friend, and Skanda's old box, and ex-boyfriend, Bruce MacArthur. And it turns out that the three men had a lot of mutual friends and acquaintances. But one thing that kind of like stood out to the police is that in the interview, Bruce MacArthur denied having a relationship with Skanda, who was his employee, but yeah. admitted to sleeping with Hamid. So that was like a weird little like, but yeah. it's also like, honestly, like Bruce MacArthur yeah, was like an older white guy, like who also
and
was
in this community, out. It's like everybody's kind of
yeah, like
you know, like
it's like there's a lot more like open sexuality and exploration, so it's like you mm-hmm. can't really like you know whatever,
yeah,
can't cast judgment on that.
Relationships are. Different, like it's just like things are a little bit different, like sleeping with somebody, like I guess that's the same
well,
thing
well sometimes and sometimes too, not yeah like the there's in the ways that anybody dates, it's like some people are monogamous and very traditional yeah. and other people are not, and if Bruce and Skanda and Hamid were not traditional, so be it. But so in April 2014, like 18 months after it started, Project Houston was closed down because it failed to return any criminal evidence. So that whole big investigation, even though they like took down a child pornography cannibal, what the hell?
Oh God, how that concoction is just messed up.
I know.
All of it.
Weird. Child total sidebar, and... but like so weird.
Oh, so weird.
So weird. So basically they shut it down, and they don't even have hard evidence that these three guys are dead. Like they could have just left or been kidnapped or something. They don't know what happened to them.
Do they outline how many people or officers or whatever they call them up
Not
there?
Not really. Like I couldn't really find Houston. Like it seemed like they were in what I read about Project Houston that they were kind of embarrassed that it failed. So there was mention of like one lead officer whose name I didn't write down because it was kind of like inconsequential, but it was something weird like Ignis or something. It was just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. So, and then, so April 2014, this shut down. Mm-hmm. And then in August 2015, another man disappeared from Church Wellesley. Okay. His name was Sarush Mahmoodi, an Iranian refugee. He was an easygoing jokester who liked to go camping and play soccer. He worked at an automotive parts factory in Barrie, Ontario. So he wasn't even from Toronto. Mm-hmm. Well, none of them were from Toronto, I guess.
Yeah.
But everyone who met Sarush liked him. He'd come to Canada as a refugee when he was 20. He didn't have any family in Canada. Mm-hmm. Eventually, he met a woman and they did get married. So he met his wife in Canada. Mm-hmm. So he was another person leading a double life. In 2008, Sarush left the factory and worked as a taxi driver in Barrie before moving to Toronto to be closer to his wife's mm-hmm. family. So he was living in Toronto at the time. And then on August 15th, 2015, Sarush was last seen alive near his apartment building on Markham Road. And he was 50 years old. So that's four immigrants, older, like not old, but like over, everyone was over 40. Everyone was brown skin, dark skin, non-white people. And only one of them was not living a secret life.
Yeah.
And they all sort of disappeared from 2010 to 2015. So this is over the course of 5 years, but the similarities in the disappearances are undeniable, even though Project Houston didn't garner the results that they wanted.
Yeah.
Which is just infuriating.
Yeah. Especially if something was like put in place after all of these people go missing. And
yeah, I mean, so it's like obviously everyone's on the same page that something is going on here.
And so far,
but when you can't find anything,
I feel like the police are trying, you know, like
because it's Canada and people are nice.
Yeah, true. Like they actually don't want people to like get away with murder.
Yeah, and they probably have the resources to do it.
Yeah, true.
They put the best horses on the case.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, do the cops up there still do, ride horses?
Mounties? Oh yeah, that's what the Mounted Patrol that searched Riverdale Park. That's what
gosh, I didn't know that. See, you learn something new every day.
So Sarush was last seen alive August 15th, 2015. He was 50 years old. Asia, you want to take it away?
In January 2016, 37-year-old Krishna Kanagaratnam went missing. He was never reported missing because, just like Skanda, he was a part of the Tamil community, and he was a part of the 492 refugees that came from Sri Lanka, and they arrived in Canada on the MV Sun Sea in August of 2010. And he was actually given a deportation order, and once that went through, he just went on the lam and was like, I'm gone. So he kind of, he was just like kind of hiding within the community. He was staying really low key. He would only reach out to his family like every once in a while just to, you know, to stay under the radar. Mm-hmm. He last talked to his family August of 2015. So to them, this was a normal thing because communication with him was very uncertain. So they, when they didn't hear from him, it was just a normal thing for him or for them. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't reported missing, and he didn't have a lot of friends or communication with other people in that community because he was hiding. And so then in April 2016, Dean Lischewick, he was either 43 or 44. I could not find his like exact age, weirdly. Mm-hmm. But he goes missing as well. Dean, just like Krishna, was not reported missing. He reportedly was last seen on April 21st, 2016. And that time, when he was last seen, he was checking into the Scott Mission shelter on Spadina Avenue. This is where he stayed frequently because over the last 3 years, because he had issues with substance abuse. So he was trying to get his life together. And mm-hmm. So he would stay at the shelter. But he was very everybody that they interviewed at the shelter said he was very respectful, very, you know, cordial with everybody. There was never a problem with him. He had many friends within the shelter that, you know, they all kind of supported each other. Mm-hmm. You know, he was trying to turn his life around. So he was doing, you know, everyday things like going out, trying to find work. He was trying to find work as a cleaner or a laborer. And the reason for that is because in the past he had worked as a sex worker. So he was trying to just clean everything up and just try to, you know, get his life on the right track. And when he went missing, they just assumed that he, you know, found a, you know, I feel like in a shelter environment, if somebody doesn't come back, that's a good thing. So everybody just kind of just assumed that he, you know, found a home. Yeah. and got things together and was able to.
I bet it's pretty common too, though, to have kind of flightiness and.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
And they can't, they're not responsible for you. You can't.
Yeah. If he leaves and down, you know, and. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all adults. So.
Yeah. About a little over a year later, on April 30th, 2017, Salim Hassan, he was a 44-year-old man. He is reported missing as well. He was last seen on April 16th, which is actually before Dean went missing. Yeah, so it's the timeline is a little off because half, they don't know the last time these people were seen definitively. So
right.
A lot of times it's a couple of people oh, I saw him on the 16th or I saw him on the 14th. So that's kind of what mm-hmm. happened in Salim's case where, yeah. you know.
And we've talked about memory and everything where you don't know
Yeah.
It's unless you are actively working on it, it's so hard to know what day, what time.
Yeah, I think this is anything. Exactly one of those cases where you can't recall the last. I mean, I guess we can now because we've been shut in the house for 3 weeks. But, you know, you don't really know. You can't tell people exactly the day and time of certain things. And I think that's right. What happened here. So April 14th, he was last seen on Bloor Street. But whoever came forward with this information didn't state who he was with or what they thought he was doing at the time. But another report says that he was last seen on March 20th.
Oh.
Yeah. So
That's way different.
Further. Yeah. Yeah. Near Yonge Street and Bloor Street.
Yeah.
Yonge? Okay. Yonge Street and Bloor Street. And this is just west of the gay village. He was reported missing by a friend on April 20th, and according to the police, he didn't have a fixed address, mm-hmm. And a lot of people reported him, like, just kind of walking around town, like, wheeling a suitcase. Mm. And so basically they just kind of assumed that he was homeless and that, you know, the unpredictability of being homeless was, you know, the answer to where right. why he was missing. But his friends were like, no, like, that's not the case. He was just in a very, quote, unhealthy relationship. Mm. So he would often, like, grab his stuff and go stay with friends for a couple of days just to get some, like, peace from that.
Oh, gosh.
But he was, yeah, and he was, but he was so connected to this person that it just always, yeah. like, blew over, and then he would go back, yeah. which is, you know, when you're in a toxic relationship like mm-hmm. that, it's very easy to just be like, everything's fine. I'm going to go back to yeah. this, to our normal. Yeah. So Salim was a Turkish citizen who he first came to Canada to be with a partner that he had met in Turkey. But that ended up not working out. And, you know, he settled in the gay community and made friends and was very, you know, much active in it. And it seemed to be, you know, an okay situation other than the fact that he did struggle with addiction. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, just like Dean, was trying to clean up his life and get on a better path. And, he just, right before he went missing, he completed a certificate course, to counsel young teens Aww. At the St. Stephen's Community Oh, wow. House. So, you know, like, I feel like he was just, like, oh, like, everybody that, like, goes missing and meets a very tragic situation is always kind of just at the cusp of doing something to better their lives and put themselves in a better situation. Yeah. And just like Dean, he was doing the same thing. This brings us to June 29th, 2017. Andrew Kinsman, he's 49. He is last seen on June 26th. He went missing from Cabbage Town near his residence on Winchester Street. It was the day after Pride Toronto. So he attended Pride Toronto and then went home, and that's the last time he was seen. Mm. People who saw him last said he seemed very happy and upbeat. But on June 28th, when his friend Ted Healy and a couple other friends didn't hear from him, they decided to go to his apartment, to see if he was okay. And they, get in and they find no signs of disturbance. Although his 17-year-old cat was out of food and water.
So he's gone for a so while.
So he was been gone for a while. So they report him missing to the police the following day. And unlike the other missing men, he was openly gay. And he was really involved in his community. He worked as a bartender in near where he lived. He was a longtime volunteer at the Toronto People with AIDS Foundation. He was a superintendent in his building. Everybody that knew him said he was a stable and responsible man. So his friends were like, he would never in a million years just like up and leave. Mm-hmm. And especially he would never leave his cat. Like apparently his cat was like near and dear to his heart, oh, like one of so his sweet. Closest. So he would like, they were like, he would never leave his cat behind. He also left his prescription medication behind, which nobody does if they're like going yeah. away or if they are up and leaving, like there's no way that they're leaving their medicine behind. No. So, and he was also really active on social media as well. So when that stopped, like you would assume that if he still had his phone with mm-hmm. him and he was still, you know, like he would still continue that. This is during the time where social media yeah. is like rampant upon everybody. So, he was 49 years old. Like I said, he was 6 feet and 4 inches tall. I had to do the math there because obviously this Ugh. Was, it said it was 1.93 meters. And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? How tall is that? Also, he's 100 kilograms, and that means he's 220 pounds.
Not kilograms.
That's what it said.
Grams?
100 kilograms. I don't know how it works.
Okay.
Me either. No, me either. So I was like, okay, I'm going to have to do the math.
Oh, I was thinking
so
milligrams.
220 pounds.
Milligrams is the small yes. grams. Kilograms is the big grams.
The okay. big ones, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, he was... God. So I did the math. He's 6'4", and he's 220 pounds. So, and they said, like, his friends described him as street savvy. So they were like, he's not going to be, like, it was unlikely to them that he was going to be a victim of violence. Right. Like, if anything, he could hold his own kind yeah. of thing.
Well, that's the thing with all these guys is they all are sort of, like, bigger, burlier bears.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So they're not, like, little, I don't know.
Scrawny yeah. little guys that can be took
they're not
yeah,
otters,
like people can take
bears.
Advantage of them. Yeah, they're bears. Yeah, and they weren't they like I saw all, like pictures of all of them, and they're all like really like big
scruffy
and like muscular and burly.
Yeah.
They've got beards. I mean, you know, they're like
it's a type.
They're not your yeah, and they're not your like typical
you
like
right.
look. You know, like it's like you if you walked up to any of them, you would never think that they were gay,
right.
but. It's like, obviously, that's something you it's okay to
yeah.
be different and have,
well,
you know,
I think
and
that,
it's just like, that's
yeah,
what they.
As people are becoming more and more open, we realize that, like, the typical look of gay is not actually a thing that exists.
It's not actually a yeah. thing. Yeah. So, but his friend said that, mm-hmm. like, he's just, you know, he's like a big burly man. Like, there's no way anybody took advantage of him and, like, he met some sort of violence. So Greg Downer, a friend of Andrew's, said that, or like after, you know, they went missing, he was the one that was kind of in the center of trying to find out what happened to Andrew and actually the other missing men, because at this time it started to become something known in the community that these men that all looked very mm-hmm. similar. They were all gay. They were all part of the same communities. Were going missing, and it was something that the community was seeing that the police
yeah.
weren't.
And this is like a course of 7 years. So imagine that feeling
yeah.
of just like that looming threat in
yeah.
your community. And like 7 years is a long time.
It's a long time to experience these like one pops of things happening to the people, and you don't really know what has happened to them. They just disappear.
Right.
They just vanish, and you're like, okay, well, when's that next person gonna come mm-hmm. along that's just vanished, you
yeah.
know? But he was at the forefront, Greg Downer, and you know, he founded a Facebook and he moderated it as well. There's actually two of them. One of them was called Find Andrew Kinsman, I'm sorry. And the other was Toronto's Missing Rainbow Community. Mm. Each of them had like over 600 members. And it was just a way for everybody to like share tips and share, you know, even like it was even lighthearted as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that people would share pictures and they would share, you know, just supportive things for these, you know, the communities to give them a little bit of the peace that they weren't getting from the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
There was even a meme uploaded with all the missing men. It was actually 12 missing gay men, all presumed gay. But it later got reduced because it was kind of outdated. And there were 5 men on that list or that picture meme that had ended up being found alive and well. Like they weren't missing. So that was a little weird.
Great.
but
like, no, I just ghosted you.
Yeah. Like, no, I just didn't want to talk to anybody. So 5 were, found alive and well. The 6th person was discovered dead, but it was suicide.
Oh.
And then a couple of the other men, were quote unquote, not gay.
Mm.
But there was a lot of speculation around that they were, but they were also leading double lives, like a lot of the
mm-hmm.
people we've talked about, and that they did go missing for a while, but it was more on the lines of that was a choice that they decided to do, and then they came back, and then just decided to say, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not gay. I have no idea what you're, you know, that's not me. Hmm. So that's a little, you know, but the other pictures included the three men or the four men that you talked about from mm-hmm. the Project Houston. And then it also included Kismin and Salim. So Andrew and Salim. So,
but not Dean.
No, Dean was not on that picture.
Okay.
Without Dean, then it was seven. Seven of the eight that we're talking about were included in that meme. Mm-hmm. And the meme also had a, like, whatever the caption, that's the word I'm thinking of, the caption of this meme, you know me, I'm not, media savvy.
Well, you keep saying meme, and I'm like, I don't think it's a, I feel like it's just like a digital flyer, not like a meme.
Yeah, that could be. I'm so bad at it. You know I'm so bad at social media. I think of memes
as being comedy.
Like,
things. Yeah, but it's just like a digital, I think what it really is. It's like a digital flyer. It's like a digital photo with words on it. That's a meme.
It's like a digital flyer. Like, that's what I'm picturing, but I think I'm using the wrong word because I'm not.
That's all right. We're here with you. Yeah.
I feel like I'm in a 29-year-old's body, but I'm actually like 68. So. The flyer suggested that there was like a serial killer involved that mm-hmm. was kind of floating around the internet.
Yeah, because that was the working theory that the community had, that they weren't really getting. They got a little bit of traction with Project Houston, but then it was like, mm-hmm. couldn't find anything. So stop saying serial killer, stop inciting panic. We're not going down that road.
Yeah, yeah. And that's pretty much what everybody was thinking. But after Andrew went missing, Project Prism Task Force was created to basically investigate. That's a good
name.
Yeah.
Because it's like a rainbow prism.
I know. He's going to
prison.
Yeah. I didn't do much research into what you were covering. Right. So I didn't really know any of the details about Project Houston. But the officers that did work on Project Houston were also working on Project Prism. And
that's an interesting choice. That feels like if you failed the first time, why do you get a second chance?
I don't know. Well, some of them were like officers from Project Houston. Some were from the sex crimes unit. There was like six officers that were from the police 51 division, which is just the area of that community. And then I think there was like only like three or four officers that came from Project Houston, and they weren't like leading it. You know, it wasn't like the lead investigators from that project. It was just like those officers were involved in.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it would. Project. Yeah. It would also be beneficial to have inside knowledge.
Yeah.
Of other things, because you like there might be something from Houston that they don't know is the key or whatever. So,
yeah. Okay, and them inviting the Project Houston officers in, just in my opinion, it basically just blankets all of these disappearances. And it for me, like if I was in that community to see that these people were, or these officers or authorities were treating all of these cases as the same, it comforts me in a way, even though it does lend to the it does like counteract what they're saying. They're saying that these aren't related, but now they're putting all of these task force and they're making them one in a way. But, and pooling they did
resources.
And they did state that this investigation was going to be difficult because of the quote lifestyle of the victims, because they did use dating apps and they did meet up with people that they had never met before. But then Andrew's friends were like, no.
Yeah, I was like, I don't think that's an excuse.
No, it's not going to be difficult because of their lifestyle. It's going to be difficult because there's a murderer out there killing our friends, our loved ones.
Yeah.
And Andrew's close friends were like, and first of all, Andrew never, like, it wasn't like sometimes he would go out and meet people that he didn't know without telling anybody, but they were like, he never went anywhere with anyone without at least telling his friends or a family member that he was going out.
Smart.
Because he knew, like, I yeah. think that he, you know, he was very responsible. Like, everybody has talked about him in that way. Mm-hmm. So don't try to put this into, like, oh, their lifestyle yeah. is the reason that this is happening to them.
That's some
no,
bullshit.
It's happening to them because there's a sick...
Someone's targeting them.
Yeah, a sick asshole's out there targeting them, yeah.
It's such victim-blamey bullshit.
Yes, and we will get into that at some point.
Ooh. Ooh. Foreshadowing.
Yes. So December 8th, 2017, the police end up updating the Project Prism. This is what they're basically telling the community. They're downplaying the suggestion that there is a serial killer in the gay village. They said, quote, "There is no conclusive evidence that any of the men met with foul play but it cannot be ruled out," end quote. So it's like, maybe.
That's like such a nothing but, yeah. thing to say.
Yeah. But it didn't help people because they were still like riddled with fear because they didn't know. And obviously, you know, an authority coming up and doing like a news thing or whatever and being like, don't worry, it's all going to be okay. Like, you shouldn't be scared is going to, and then not giving them any information is mm-hmm. aiding their fear. It's making yeah. them even more scared because they have no idea.
Look at what Trump like, is doing right now.
I know. I was just thinking, like, I feel like I'm talking about what's happening right yeah. now in our lives.
It's the cycle of leadership. Yes. The lies, like, mistrust build.
Mm-hmm.
And then people die.
It's like if you constantly tell somebody in the middle of, oh, actually, I think it was like, what did I read that on? I read it or watched it somewhere. It might have been, oh, it was The Daily Show. And I love Trevor Noah mm-hmm. so much. But he explained it very well. He was just like, you know what? This is the difference between good leadership and bad leadership. Mm. When you're on an airplane and the pilot comes on and says, hey, guys, so we're going to hit a... It's going to be a little bumpy outside. It's going to be a little bumpy. So I'm going to suspend food service. Please keep your seatbelt on. I'm going to try to get to an altitude that is a little smoother for us. Once that mm-hmm. happens, I will turn the seatbelt sign off and we will continue our normal in-flight, you know, mm-hmm. festivities. But like, and then once you get up there and you're experiencing all these bumps and you're experiencing turbulence, you're prepared for it. And even yeah. though it's still uncertain, you still feel that sense of comfort because you were warned, you were told right. that, listen, we're going to do our best to figure this out and everything will be okay.
Yeah.
Rather than them not saying anything and you start experiencing turbulence, the flight attendant has fallen over, everybody's like in a middle, you know, everybody's in the bathroom and up and walking and falling over. Mm-hmm. And then you're experiencing all of these crazy things happening. And then somebody of authority gets on and says, guys, everything else, it's okay. Don't worry. Like, yeah. no, I should be worried because things are falling apart. What are you talking about? Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they experienced here. They were like, okay, we're all feeling very threatened, very fearful of even going outside and doing our daily normal things. And you're going to stand up there and say, actually, you know what? There's no conclusive evidence that this is a thing, but let's not rule it out. Let's yeah. not say that it isn't, but it is at the same time. So it doesn't God. Help them at all. They're all still very like, okay, this is not going well. And it doesn't help at all when on November 29th, the body of Tess Ritchie was found by her mom in an alleyway just 4 days after she was reported missing. The following day, it was announced that the body of Alora Wells, a homeless transgender woman, was also found. She was reported missing from her shelter. The fears just keep increasing because yeah. even though these two women's deaths weren't related to the missing gay men in the community.
In the moment, you don't know that. They're the first
you don't
bodies
know.
They found.
Yeah, there's the first bodies that they found, and it's the first two women that they
yeah.
found from that community.
Yeah.
And even though at the end of the day, we find out that they weren't related, it still didn't help because nobody mm-hmm. was saying anything.
Yeah.
So, So then, you know, the TPS, he's Chief Mark Sanders, he holds a news conference after that, basically saying the same thing over again, that these cases are not related. There are three separate investigations, the investigation into the homicide of Richie and the death of Alora Wells and the disappearance of the Kingsman and Asen are totally different investigations. And he said, even though that they've all occurred in the same, the close proximity, the police are saying that there is no evidence of a serial killer, which is infuriating. Mm-hmm. So we do know that the disappearance of Andrew was at the forefront of Project Prism because, after his disappearance is when they decided to put together Project Prism. Mm-hmm. But at the end of July, their first crucial piece of evidence is found. So, because Andrew was reported missing within the first 72 hours of his disappearance, the evidence that they were able to find was very new and fresh. And mm-hmm. in the other cases, it wasn't so much like that. Like, people waited a week, or they waited a significant amount of time, or they didn't have, you know, any fixed, like, addresses or stuff like that. So they didn't really have much to go on. Harder
to search and everything.
Yeah. So Andrew was kind of the perfect case in that way, because he did have roots in the community. He had a home. He had, you know, family and friends and a routine that they were able to follow. So when the police searched his apartment, they found a lot of stuff. So they found things that connected him to, like, what he did. That's how they found out, you know, that he went to the Pride Toronto. Mm-hmm. But one of the key things that they found was his calendar.
Mm, and boy keeps the calendar.
He does. This is why everyone very, should do that. Yes. And he's very meticulous. He's, you know, he's very type A, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like we would have gotten along.
I think so, too. We would have been mm-hmm. great friends. So on the day he went missing, June 26th, Andrew had penciled in the name Bruce on his calendar.
Bruce.
I feel like we've heard that name from you. Do you guys remember a lot.
Anybody named Bruce?
Yes. Hmm. So the police obviously started a huge investigation right away, because they knew, okay, this was the day he went missing. He had plans to meet Bruce. Mm-hmm. So they needed to find out who Bruce was. So they pulled surveillance videos revealing Andrew approaching a vehicle the day he went missing. There was no visible license plate number, but it did have chrome siding and was later identified as the 2004 Dodge Caravan.
Dodge Caravan.
Yes. So I think it was red, too. A red Dodge Caravan. Oh,
of course it was.
Blech. Yeah.
Sorry if you have a red Dodge Caravan.
Yeah. There was more than 6,000 similar models in Toronto at the time, but only 5 were registered to someone named Bruce.
I love a good narrow down.
I know. And of all of the 2004 models, there was one that belonged to a man named Bruce MacArthur.
Bruce MacArthur.
Yes. And he came up, obviously, in most of the cases that they found. So, and to their surprise, he had already been or had run-ins with the police and had similar encounters and situations with gay men in the area.
So, just if you don't remember from my section, Bruce mm-hmm. MacArthur was Skanda's boss at the landscaping company. Mm-hmm. And Skanda's ex-boyfriend, who was the one that denied he slept with Skanda, but did sleep with Hamid. Mm-hmm. So this little Bruce guy just popping up everywhere.
Okay, so let's backtrack a little. So on June 20th, 2016, just for a little clarification, this is right before Salim and Andrew disappeared. Mm-hmm. A man by the name of Isaac. This is not his real name. He would only come forward and do interviews and stuff like that if they did not give his real name. Mm-hmm. So he was a mechanic in the Canadian Forces for about 7 years. But then, but at the time of this incident, he was working in an auto shop in Toronto.
Is Canadian Forces military?
That would have been a good thing for me to look up, but I didn't.
If you know what the Canadian Forces are, let us know.
Yeah, I let's just assume that's okay. A thing. So, so he said that he met Bruce MacArthur online around 2011, so 5 years before that.
Wow.
He knew Bruce very well. He said that they were in an on and off relationship for a few years. He said, quote, "I liked him. I thought he was a nice guy. We never had a problem and we always got along and he enjoyed it and I enjoyed it," end quote. Isaac said that he felt like around this time, he felt kind of stalked by MacArthur. Mm. He said he would often like just show up to his house, like unannounced.
Don't do that. Nobody
it gets worse. It gets so worse. So he would like show up to his house without saying anything and just like be there. He would leave notes on his windshield, like at work. So he'd get off work and go in to get in his car and he'd have like a note like taped to his windshield. He said, quote, "He would be sitting in my driveway many times when I got home." He said, all of a sudden, he would just, like, show up at my window sometimes.
That's so weird. So scary.
Red flags right away. Yes. But I understand, like, he's known him now for, like, 5 years.
It's just is like, a little bit, like, of a, your a hookup friend that just, like, exactly. comes around too much. And you're like, okay. It's a little bit of a boundary issue.
Weird, weird, weird. So... so then on June 20th, this is the day of the incident, the two, met up in a public parking lot near, Bathurst Street and Finch Street. I'm sorry, Finch mm-hmm. Avenue. So, and he said MacArthur was like insistent that he get in the van. And he was just like, you know, like, I think their normal thing was they would meet up and then they would go to a, their his house or they he said that they never went to Bruce's house, that he would always come to his house. So I think that was like the general like idea was that they were just going to like go somewhere and have a drink or whatever. But he was like very insistent that he get in the van. Isaac recalls, quote, on the van floor were construction tarps, but I didn't think twice of it because this guy was a landscaper," end quote.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So, but on the inside, he asked, MacArthur told him to lay down on the floor. So he kind of thought like, oh, this is, he's just getting right to, right to it kind of thing. And, he noticed that the middle seats were removed. And that all, like, once he got in, that all of a sudden Bruce grabbed his neck and started choking him. Isaac said he was holding so tightly to around his neck that he could feel his eyes bulging.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He said, quote, "We were laying down. He was on top of me. He had his legs over my legs. My arms were under his weight." He said, quote, "His face turned from a smile to a scowl. He had hatred and anger in his eyes."
Oh, no.
Yeah. So this is how, like, he's totally caught off guard. He's known this guy forever. Like, he's like, I can't, like, he just doesn't understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. But he said, quote, "I knew he was going to kill me." He said that he remembers thinking about his mom during that time. And he said, quote, "She is not going to bury me. No way."
Ooh.
End quote.
Oh, my God.
I know. It gives me the chills. So he said with his last bit of strength, he was able to just kind of maneuver and break free from Bruce's hold. And so he like flipped over on his stomach, which threw MacArthur off of him. And he said when he let go of his neck, that was the sweetest breath of fresh air he ever had.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, I couldn't imagine. It's like, ugh. So Isaac said that once MacArthur was off of him, he kind of flipped over and got on top of him, and he was like screaming at him, and he said, I thought about killing him. He said, but then I didn't. And it's like, yeah, you didn't because you're not a psychopath.
Yeah.
Like, you that's have humanity. Why. Yeah. Like, of course you don't want to kill somebody. Even after someone tried to kill you, his first reaction is to not kill him, you know? But instead he grabbed the handle of the van door and got out. He said that once he was outside, he looked back at him and he said, quote, what the fuck is the matter with you? And then Isaac said, I'm calling the police. Stay here. So then he walks back to his vehicle to call the police. Mm-hmm. And so he calls the cops and he says, quote, someone just tried to strangle me. Just somebody get here, end quote. Isaac had a dashboard cam on his car. So as he was calling the police, the video captured Bruce in getting back in his car and speeding away.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, because of like he's telling him, oh, I'm going to call the police. Like, of course, he's going to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
So so then Isaac jumps in his car and he tries to chase him down.
Oh, my God.
But he's on the phone with the police and the police are like, don't chase after him. Pull over and go back. So he pulls over. He goes back to the parking lot where they were. And Isaac said that when the emergency, the police and the emergency responders arrived, he was just alone in a parking lot. So he says, like, he immediately begins to think, how do I prove this?
We'll prove it next episode.
So next week, we will get into more details about the Toronto serial killer, who we now know is Bruce MacArthur, and discuss the media attention and the societal factors of this case. So please tune in next week as Devin and I, again, tell the story together.
This episode is written by Devin Balsamo-Gillis and Asia Hamilton.
And edited by Devin Balsamo-Gillis.
With music by the wonderful Holly Amber Church.
If you would like to see pictures and our sources from part one of this case, please check us out on Instagram at DNA_podcast.
Please rate, review, subscribe on iTunes or any listening platform. We're available everywhere.
See you next time.
I went for a different delivery that time.